killed two men in Lahore who had approached his car on a motorbike. He said they had attempted to rob him. The Americans claimed he was not CIA, but an ordinary diplomat, which made everyone very suspicious. Even we schoolchildren know that ordinary diplomats don't drive around in unmarked cars carrying Glock pistols. Our media claimed that Davis was part of a vast secret army that the CIA had sent to Pakistan because they didn't trust our intelligence agencies. He was said to be spying on a militant group called Lashkar-e-Taiba based in Lahore. They were thought to be behind the terrible Mumbai massacre of 2008. The group's main objective was to liberate Kashmir's Muslims from Indian rule, but they had recently also become active in Afghanistan. Other people said Davis was really spying on our nuclear weapons. Raymond Davis quickly became the most famous American in Pakistan. There were protests all over the country. People imagined our bazaars were full of Raymond Davises gathering intelligence to send back to the States. Then the widow of one of the men Davis had murdered took rat poison and killed herself, despairing of receiving justice. It took weeks of back and forth between Washington and Islamabad, or rather Army headquarters in Rawalpindi, before the case was finally resolved. What they did was like our traditional jirgas. The Americans paid blood money, amounting to $2.3 million, and Davis was quickly spirited out of court and out of the country. Pakistan then demanded that the CIA send home many of its contractors and stopped approving visas. The whole affair left a lot of bad feeling, particularly because on March 17th, the day after Davis was released, a huge drone attack on a tribal council in North Waziristan killed about 40 people. The attack seemed to send the message that the CIA could do as it pleased in our country. One Monday, I was about to measure myself against the wall to see if I had miraculously grown in the night when I heard loud voices next door. My father's friends had arrived with news that was hard to believe. During the night, American Special Forces called Navy SEALs had carried out a raid in Abbottabad, one of the places we'd stayed as IDPs, and had found and killed Osama bin Laden. He had been living in a large walled compound less than a mile from our military academy. We couldn't believe the army had been oblivious to bin Laden's whereabouts. The newspapers said that the cadets even did their training in the field alongside the house. The compound had 12-foot-high walls, topped with barbed wire. Bin Laden lived on the top floor with his youngest wife, a Yemeni woman named Amal. Two other wives and his 11 children lived below them. An American senator said that the only thing missing from bin Laden's hideaway was a neon sign. In truth, lots of our people in Pashtun areas lived in walled compounds because of purdah and privacy, so the house wasn't really unusual. What was odd was that the residents never went out, and the house had no phone or internet connections. Their food was brought in by two brothers who also lived in the compound with their wives. They acted as couriers for bin Laden. One of the wives was from Swat. The Navy SEALs had shot bin Laden in the head, and his body had been flown away by helicopter. It didn't sound as though he had put up a fight. The two brothers and one of bin Laden's grown-up sons had also been killed, but bin Laden's wives and other children had been tied up and left behind and were then taken into Pakistani custody. The Americans dumped bin Laden's body at sea. President Obama was very happy, and on TV we watched big celebrations take place outside the White House. At first, we assumed our government had known and been involved in the American operation. But we soon found out that the Americans had gone it alone. This didn't sit well with our people. We were supposed to be allies, and we had lost more soldiers in their war on terror than they had. They had entered the country at night, flying low and using special quiet helicopters. They blocked our radar with electronic interference. They had only announced their mission to the Army Chief of Staff, General Ashfaq Kayani, and President Zardari after the event. Most of the Army leadership learnt about it on TV. The Americans said they had no choice but to do it like that because no one really knew which side the ISI was on, and someone might have tipped off bin Laden before they reached him. The director of the CIA said Pakistan was either involved or incompetent. Neither place is a good place to be. My father said it was a shameful day. How could a notorious terrorist be hiding in Pakistan and remain undetected for so many years, he asked. Others were asking the same thing. You can see why anyone would think our intelligence services must have known bin Laden's location. ISI is a huge organization with agents everywhere. How could he have lived so close to the capital, just 60 miles away, and for so long? Maybe the best place to hide is in plain sight, but he had been living in that house since the 2005 earthquake. Two of his children were even born in the Abbottabad hospital, and he'd been in Pakistan for more than 9 years. Before Abbottabad, he'd been in Haripur, and before that, hidden away in our own Swat Valley, where he met up with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11. The way bin Laden was caught was like something out of a spy movie. To avoid detection, he used human couriers rather than phones or emails. But the Americans had discovered one of his couriers tracked the number plate of his car and followed it from Peshawar to Abbottabad. After that, they monitored the house with a kind of giant drone that has X-ray vision and which spotted a very tall bearded man pacing round the compound. They called him the Pacer. People were intrigued by the new details that came every day, but they seemed angrier at the American incursion than at the fact that the world's biggest terrorist had been living on our soil. Some newspapers ran stories saying that the Americans had actually killed bin Laden years before this and kept his body in a freezer. The story was that they had then planted the body in Abbottabad and faked the raid to embarrass Pakistan. We started to receive text messages asking us to rally in the streets and show our support of the army. We were there for you in 1948, 1965, and 1971. Said one message, referring to our three wars with India. Be with us now when we have been stabbed in the back. But there were also text messages which ridiculed the army. People asked how we could be spending $6 billion a year on the military, 7 times more than we were spending on education, if 4 American helicopters could just sneak in under our radar. And if they could do it, what was to stop the Indians next door? Please don't honk, the army is sleeping, said one text. Second-hand Pakistani radar for sale. Can't detect US helicopters, but gets cable TV just fine, said another. General Kayani and General Amir Shuja Pasha, the head of ISI, were called to testify in parliament, something that had never happened. Our country had been humiliated, and we wanted to know why. We also learned that American politicians were furious that bin Laden had been living under our noses when all along they had imagined he was hiding in a cave. They complained that they had given us $20 billion over an 8-year period to cooperate, and it was questionable which side we were on. Sometimes it felt as though it was all about the money. Most of the money had gone to the army. Ordinary people received nothing. In October 2011, my father told me he had received an email informing him I was one of the 5 nominees for the International Peace Prize of Kids' Rights, a children's advocacy group based in Amsterdam. My name had been put forward by Archbishop Desmond Tutu from South Africa. He was a great hero of my father for his fight against apartheid. My father was disappointed when I didn't win, but I pointed out to him that all I had done was speak out. We didn't have an organization doing practical things like the award winners had. Shortly after that, I was invited by the Chief Minister of Punjab, Shahbaz Sharif, to speak in Lahore at an education gala. He built a network of new schools he calls Danish schools and gave free laptops to students, even if they did have his picture on their screens when you switched them on. To motivate students in all provinces, he gave cash awards to the girls and boys who scored well in their exams. I was presented with a check for ₹500,000, about $4,500, for my campaign for girls' rights. I wore pink to the gala, and for the first time talked publicly about how we had defied the Taliban edict and carried on going to school secretly. I know the importance of education because my pens and books were taken from me by force, I said. But the girls of Swat are not afraid of anyone. We have continued with our education. Then I was in class one day when my classmate said, "You have won a big prize and ₹500,000. My father told me the government had awarded me Pakistan's first ever National Peace Prize. I couldn't believe it. So many journalists thronged to the school that day that it turned into a news studio. The ceremony was on 20th December 2011 at the Prime Minister's official residence, one of the big white mansions on the hill at the end of Constitution Avenue, which I had seen on my trip to Islamabad. By then, I was used to meeting politicians. I was not nervous, though my father tried to intimidate me by saying Prime Minister Jilani came from a family of saints. After the PM presented me with the award and check, I presented him with a long list of demands. I told him that we wanted our schools rebuilt and a girls' university in Swat. I knew he would not take my demands seriously, so I didn't push very hard. I thought, one day I will be a politician and do these things myself. It was decided that the prize should be awarded annually to children under 18 years old and be named the Malala Prize in my honor. I noticed my father was not very happy with this. Like most Pashtuns, he is a bit superstitious. In Pakistan, we don't have a culture of honoring people while they are alive, only the dead, so he thought it was a bad omen. I know my mother didn't like the awards, because she feared I would become a target as I was becoming more well-known. She herself would never appear in public. She refused even to be photographed. She is a very traditional woman, and this is our centuries-old culture. Were she to break that tradition, men and women would talk against her, particularly those in our own family. She never said she regretted the work my father and I had undertaken, but when I won prizes, she said, "I don't want awards. I want my daughter. I wouldn't exchange a single eyelash of my daughter for the whole world." My father argued that all he had ever wanted was to create a school in which children could learn. We had been left with no choice but to get involved in politics and campaign for education. "My only ambition," he said, "is to educate my children and my nation as much as I am able. But when half of your leaders tell lies and the other half is negotiating with the Taliban, there is nowhere to go. One has to speak out." When I returned home, I was greeted with the news that there were a group of journalists who wanted to interview me at school, and that I should wear a nice outfit. First, I thought of wearing a very beautiful dress, but then I decided to wear something more modest for the interview, as I wanted people to focus on my message and not my clothes. When I arrived at school, I saw all my friends had dressed up. "Surprise!" they shouted when I walked in. They had collected money and organized a party for me with a big white cake, on which was written "Success Forever" in chocolate icing. It was wonderful that my friends wanted to share in my success. I knew that any of the girls in my class could have achieved what I had achieved if they had had their parents' support. "Now you can get back to schoolwork," said Madame Mariam as we finished off the cake. "Exams in March." But the year ended on a sad note. 5 days after I got the award, my aunt Babo, my mother's eldest sister, died suddenly. She wasn't even 50 years old. She was diabetic and had seen a TV advert of a doctor in Lahore with some miracle treatment and persuaded my uncle to take her there. We don't know what the doctor injected her with, but she went into shock and died. My father said the doctor was a charlatan, and this was why we needed to keep struggling against ignorance. I had amassed a lot of money by the end of the year, 500,000 rupees each from the Prime Minister, the Chief Minister of Punjab, the Chief Minister of our state Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, and the Sindh government. Major General Ghulam Khamar, the local army commander, also gave our school 100,000 rupees to build a science laboratory and a library. But my fight wasn't over. I was reminded of our history lessons, in which we learnt about the bounty an army enjoys when a battle is won. I began to see the awards and recognition just like that. They were little jewels without much meaning. I needed to concentrate on winning the war. My father used some of the money to buy me a new bed and cabinet and pay for tooth implants for my mother and a piece of land in Shangla. We decided to spend the rest of the money on people who needed help. I wanted to start an education foundation. This had been on my mind ever since I'd seen the children working in the rubbish mountain. I still could not shake the image of the black rats I had seen there, and the girl with the matted hair who had been sorting rubbish. We held a conference of 21 girls and made our priority education for every girl in Swat, with a particular focus on street children and those in child labor. As we crossed the Malakand Pass, I saw a young girl selling oranges. She was scratching marks on a piece of paper with a pencil to account for the oranges she had sold, as she could not read or write. I took a photo of her and vowed I would do everything in my power to help educate girls just like her. This was the war I was going to fight. 18. The Woman and the Sea. Aunt Najma was in tears. She had never seen the sea before. My family and I sat on the rocks gazing across the water, breathing in the salt tang of the Arabian Sea. It was such a big expanse. Surely no one could know where it ended. At that moment, I was very happy. "One day, I want to cross this sea," I said. "What is she saying?" asked my aunt, as if I was talking about something impossible. I was still trying to get my head around the fact that she had been living in the seaside city of Karachi for 30 years, and yet had never actually laid eyes on the ocean. Her husband would not take her to the beach, and even if she had somehow slipped out of the house, she would not have been able to follow the signs to the sea because she could not read. I sat on the rocks and thought about the fact that across the water were lands where women were free. In Pakistan, we had had a woman prime minister, and in Islamabad, I had met those impressive working women. Yet the fact was that we were a country where almost all the women depended entirely on men. My headmistress Maryam was a strong, educated woman. But in our society, she could not live on her own and come to work. She had to be living with a husband, brother, or parents. In Pakistan, when women say they want independence, people think this means we don't want to obey our fathers, brothers, or husbands. But it does not mean that. It means we want to make decisions for ourselves. We want to be free to go to school or go to work. Nowhere is it written in the Quran that a woman should be dependent on a man. The word has not come down from the heavens to tell us that every woman should listen to a man. "You are a million miles away, Jani," said my father, interrupting my thoughts. "What are you dreaming about?" "Just about crossing oceans, Abba," I replied. "Forget all that," shouted my brother Atul. "We're at the beach, and I want to go for a camel ride." It was January 2012, and we were in Karachi as guests of GeoTV after the Sindh government announced they were renaming a girls' secondary school on Mission Road in my honor. My brother Khushal was now at school in Abbottabad, so it was just me, my parents, and Atal. We flew to Karachi, and it was the first time any of us had ever been on a plane. The journey was just 2 hours, which I found incredible. It would have taken us at least 2 days by bus. On the plane, we noticed that some people could not find their seats because they could not read letters and numbers. I had a window seat and could see the deserts and mountains of our land below me. As we headed south, the land became more parched. I was already missing the green of Swat. I could see why when our people go to Karachi to work, but they always want to be buried in the cool of our valley. Driving from the airport to the hostel, I was amazed by the number of people and houses and cars. Karachi is one of the biggest cities on earth. It was strange to think it was just a port of 300,000 people when Pakistan was created. Jinnah lived there and made it our first capital, and it was soon flooded by millions of Muslim refugees from India, known as Muhajirs, which means immigrants and speak Urdu. Today, it has around 20 million people. It's actually the largest Pashtun city in the world, even though it is far from our lands. Between 5 and 7 million Pashtuns have gone there to work. Unfortunately, Karachi has also become a very violent city, and there is always fighting between the Muhajirs and Pashtuns. The Muhajir areas we saw all seemed very organized and neat, whereas the Pashtun areas were dirty and chaotic. The Muhajirs almost all support a party called the MQM, led by Altaf Hussain, who lives in exile in London and communicates with his people by Skype. The MQM is a very organized movement, and the Muhajir community sticks together. By contrast, we Pashtuns are very divided, some following Imran Khan because he is Pashtun, a Khan, and a great cricketer. Some follow Maulana Fazlur Rehman because his party JUI is Islamic. Some the secular ANP because it's a Pashtun nationalist party. And some the PPP of Benazir Bhutto or PMLN of Nawaz Sharif. We went to the Sindh Assembly where I was applauded by all the members. Then we went to visit some schools, including the one that was being named after me. I made a speech about the importance of education and also talked about Benazir Bhutto as this was her city. We must all work together for the rights of girls, I said. The children sang for me and I was presented with a painting of me looking up at the sky. It was both odd and wonderful to see my name on a school just like Malalai of Maiwan, after whom so many schools in Afghanistan are named. In the next school holidays, my father and I planned to go and talk to parents and children in the distant hilly areas of Swat about the importance of learning to read and write. We will be like preachers of education, I said. Later that day, we visited my aunt and uncle. They lived in a very small house, and so at last my father understood why they had refused to take him in when he was a student. On the way, we passed through Ashikhan-e-Rasool Square and were shocked to see a picture of the murderer of Governor Salam Taseer, decorated with garlands of rose petals, as though he were a saint. My father was angry. In a city of 20 million people, is there not one person who will take this down? There was one important place we had to include in our visit to Karachi, beside our outings to the sea or the huge bazaars where my mother bought lots of clothes. We needed to visit the mausoleum of our founder and great leader, Muhammad Ali Jinnah. This is a very peaceful building of white marble and somehow seemed separate from the hustle and bustle of the city. It felt sacred to us. Benazir was on her way there to make her first speech on her return to Pakistan when her bus was blown up. The guard explained that the tomb in the main room, under a giant chandelier from China, did not contain Jinnah's body. The real tomb is on the floor below, where he lies alongside his sister Fatima, who died much later. Next to it is the tomb of our first Prime Minister, Liaquat Ali Khan, who was assassinated. Afterwards, we went into the small museum at the back, which had displays of the special white bow ties Jinnah used to order from Paris, his three-piece suits tailored in London, his golf clubs, and a special traveling box with drawers for 12 pairs of shoes, including his favorite two-tone brogues. The walls were covered with photographs. In the ones from the early days of Pakistan, you could easily see from his thin, sunken face that Jinnah was dying. But at the time, it was kept a secret. Jinnah smoked 50 cigarettes a day. His body was riddled with TB and lung cancer when Lord Mountbatten, the last British governor of India, agreed that India would be divided at independence. Afterwards, he said that had he known Jinnah was dying, he would have delayed and there would have been no Pakistan. As it was, Jinnah died in September 1948, just over a year later. Then, less than 3 years after that, our first Prime Minister was killed. Right from the start, we were an unlucky country. Some of Jinnah's most famous speeches were displayed. There was the one about people of all religions being free to worship in the new Pakistan, and another where he had spoken about the important role of women. I wanted to see pictures of the women in his life, but his wife died young and was a Parsi, and their only daughter Dina stayed in India and married a Parsi, which didn't sit very well in the new Muslim homeland. Now she lives in New York. So the only pictures I found were of his sister, Fatima. It was hard to visit that place and read these speeches without thinking that Jinnah would be very disappointed in Pakistan. He would probably say that this was not the country he had wanted. He wished us to be independent, to be tolerant, to be kind to each other. He wanted everyone to be free, whatever their belief. Would it have been better if we had not become independent but stayed part of India? I asked my father. It seemed to me that before Pakistan, there was just endless fighting between Hindus and Muslims. Then even when we got our own country, there was still fighting. But this time, it was between the Muhajirs and Pashtuns and between Sunni and Shia. Instead of celebrating each other, our four provinces struggled to get along. Sindhis often talk of separation, and in Balochistan there is an ongoing war which gets talked about very little because it is so remote. Did all this fighting mean we needed to divide our country yet again? When we left the museum, some young men with flags were protesting outside. They told us they were Saraiki speakers from southern Punjab and wanted their own province. There seemed to be so many things about which people were fighting. If Christians, Hindus or Jews are really our enemies, as so many say, why are we Muslims fighting with each other? Our people have become misguided. They think their greatest concern is defending Islam and are being led astray by those like the Taliban who deliberately misinterpret the Quran. We should focus on practical issues. We have so many people in our country who are illiterate, and many women have no education at all. We live in a place where schools are blown up. We have no reliable electricity supply. Not a single day passes without the killing of at least one Pakistani. One day, a lady called Sheila Anjum turned up at our hostel. She was a Pakistani journalist living in Alaska and wanted to meet me after she'd seen the documentary about us on the New York Times website. She chatted with me for a while, then with my father. I noticed she had tears in her eyes. Then she asked my father, "Did you know, Ziauddin, that the Taliban have threatened this innocent girl?" We didn't know what she was talking about, so she went on the internet and showed us that the Taliban had that day issued threats against two women, Shah Begum, an activist in Deer, and me, Malala. "These two are spreading secularism and should be killed," it said. I didn't take it seriously, as there are so many things on the internet, and I thought we would have heard from somewhere if it were real. That evening, my father received a call from the family who had been sharing our home with us for the last 18 months. Their previous home had a mudroof which leaked in the rain, and we had two spare rooms, so they stayed with us for a nominal rent, and their children went to our school for free. They had three children, and we liked them living with us, as we all played cops and robbers on the roof. They told my father that the police had turned up at the house and demanded to know whether we had received any threats. When my father heard this, he called the deputy superintendent, who asked him the same thing. My father asked, "Why? Have you any information?" The officer asked to see my father when we were back in Swat. After that, my father was restless and could not enjoy Karachi. I could see my mother and father were both very upset. I knew my mother was still mourning my aunt, and they had been feeling uneasy about me receiving so many awards. But it seemed to be about more than that. "Why are you like this?" I asked. "You're worried about something, but you're not telling us." Then they told me about the call from home, and that they were taking the threats seriously. I don't know why, but hearing I was being targeted did not worry me. It seemed to me that everyone knows they will die one day. My feeling was, nobody can stop death. It doesn't matter if it comes from a talib or cancer. So I should do whatever I want to do. "Maybe we should stop our campaigning, Jani, and go into hibernation for a time," said my father. "How can we do that?" I replied. "You are the one who said if we believe in something greater than our lives, then our voices will only multiply, even if we are dead. We can't disown our campaign." People were asking me to speak at events. How could I refuse, saying there was a security problem? We couldn't do that, especially not as proud Pashtuns. My father always says that heroism is in the Pashtun DNA. Still, it was with a heavy heart that we returned to Swat. When my father went to the police, they showed him a file on me. They told him that my national and international profile meant I had attracted attention and death threats from the Taliban, and that I needed protection. They offered us guards, but my father was reluctant. Many elders in Swat were killed despite having bodyguards, and the Punjab governor had been killed by his own bodyguard. He also thought armed guards would alarm the parents of the students at school, and he didn't want to put others at risk. When he had had threats before, he had always said, "Let them kill me, but I'll be killed alone." He suggested sending me to boarding school in Abbottabad like Khushal, but I did not want to go. He also met the local army colonel who said being in college in Abbottabad would not really be any safer, and that as long as I kept a low profile, we would be okay. So when the government of KPK offered to make me a peace ambassador, my father said it was better to refuse. Back home, I started bolting the main gate of our house at night. "She smells the threat," my mother told my father. He was very unhappy. He kept telling me to draw the curtains in my room at night, but I would not. "Abba, this is a very strange situation," I told him. "When there was Talibanization, we were safe. Now there is no Taliban, we are unsafe." "Yes, Malala," he replied. "Now the Talibanization is especially for us, for those like you and me who continue to speak out. The rest of Swat is okay. The rickshaw drivers, the shopkeepers are all safe. This is Talibanization for particular people, and we are among them." There was another downside to receiving those awards. I was missing a lot of school. After the exams in March, the cup that went into my new cabinet was for second place. 19. A private Talibanization. "Let's pretend it's a Twilight movie and that we're the vampires in the forest, I said to Muniba. We were on a school trip to Margaza, a beautiful green valley where the air is cool and there's a tall mountain and a crystal clear river where we were planning to have a picnic. Nearby was the White Palace Hotel that used to be the Wali's summer residence. It was April 2012, the month after our exams, so we were all feeling relaxed. We were a group of about 70 girls. Our teachers and my parents were there too. My father had hired 3 flying coaches, but we could not all fit in, so 5 of us, me, Muniba, and 3 other girls, were in the diner, the school van. It wasn't very comfortable, especially because we also had giant pots of chicken and rice on the floor for the picnic. But it was only half an hour's drive. We had fun singing songs on the way there. Muniba was looking very beautiful, her skin porcelain pale. What skin creams are you using? I asked her. The same one you are using, she replied. I knew that could not be true. No, look at my dark skin and look at yours. We visited the White Palace and saw where the Queen had slept and the gardens of beautiful flowers. Sadly, we could not see the Wali's room as it had been damaged by the floods. We ran around for a while in the green forest, then took some photographs and waded into the river and started splashing each other with water. The drops sparkled in the sun. There was a waterfall down the cliff, and for a while we sat on the rocks and listened to it. Then Muniba started splashing me again. Don't, I don't want to get my clothes wet, I pleaded. I walked off with 2 other girls she didn't like. The other girls stirred things up, what we call putting masala on the situation. It was a recipe for another argument between Muniba and me. That put me in a bad mood, but I cheered up when we got to the top of the cliff where lunch was being prepared. Usman Baijan, our driver, made us laugh as usual. Madame Miriam had bought her baby boy and Hannah, her 2-year-old, who looked a little like a doll but was full of mischief. Lunch was a disaster. When the school assistants put the pans on the fire to heat up the chicken curry, they panicked that there was not enough food for so many girls, so they added water from the stream. We said it was the worst lunch ever. It was so watery that one girl said, "The sky could be seen in the soupy curry." Like on all our trips, my father got us all to stand on a rock and talk about our impressions of the day before we left. This time, all anyone talked about was how bad the food was. My father was embarrassed and for once short of words. The next morning, a school worker came with milk, bread and eggs to our house for our breakfast. My father always answered the door, as women must stay inside. The man told him the shopkeeper had given him a photocopied letter. When my father read it, he went pale. "By God, this is terrible propaganda against our school," he told my mother. He read it out. "Dear Muslim brothers, there is a school, the Hushal School, which is run by an NGO. NGOs have a very bad reputation among religious people in our country, so this was a way to invite people's wrath, and is a center of vulgarity and obscenity. It is a hadith of the Holy Prophet that if you see something bad or evil, you should stop it with your own hand. If you are unable to do that, then you should tell others about it, and if you can't do that, you should think about how bad it is in your heart. I have no personal quarrel with the principal, but I am telling you what Islam says. This school is a center of vulgarity and obscenity, and they take girls for picnics to different resorts. If you don't stop it, you will have to answer to God on doomsday. Go and ask the manager of the White Palace Hotel, and he will tell you what these girls did." He put down the piece of paper. "It has no signature. Anonymous." We sat stunned. "They know no one will ask the manager," said my father. "People will just imagine something terrible went on." "We know what happened there. The girls did nothing bad," my mother reassured him. My father called my cousin Khanji to find out how widely the letters had been distributed. He called back with bad news. They had been left everywhere, though most shopkeepers ignored them and threw them away. There were also giant posters pasted on the front of the mosque with the same accusations. At school, my classmates were terrified. "Oh, sir, they are saying very bad things about our school," they said to my father. "What will our parents say?" My father gathered all the girls into the courtyard. "Why are you afraid?" he asked. "Did you do anything against Islam? Did you do anything immoral?" "No. You just splashed water and took pictures. So don't be scared." This is the propaganda of the followers of Mullah Fazlullah. Down with them. You have the right to enjoy greenery and waterfalls and landscape, just as boys do. My father spoke like a lion, but I could see in his heart he was worried and scared. Only one person came and withdrew his sister from the school, but we knew that was not the end of it. Shortly after that, we were told a man who had completed a peace walk from Dera Ismail Khan was coming through Mingora, and we wanted to welcome him. I was on the way to meet him with my parents when we were approached by a short man who seemed to be frantically talking on two different phones. "Don't go that way," he urged. "There is a suicide bomber over there." We'd promised to meet the peace walker, so we went a different route, placed a garland round his neck, then left quickly for home. All through that spring and summer, odd things kept happening. Strangers came to the house asking questions about my family. My father said they were from the intelligence services. The visits became more frequent after my father and the Swat Kwami Jirga held a meeting in our school to protest against army plans for the people of Mingora and our community defense committees to conduct night patrols. "The army say there is peace," said my father. "So why do we need flag marches and night patrols?" Then our school hosted a painting competition for the children of Mingora that was sponsored by my father's friend who ran an NGO for women's rights. The pictures were supposed to show equality of the sexes or highlight discrimination against women. That morning, two men from the intelligence services came to our school to see my father. "What is going on in your school?" they demanded. "This is a school," he replied. "There's a painting competition, just as we have debating competitions, cookery competitions, and essay contests." The men got very angry, and so did my father. "Everyone knows me and what I do," he said. "Why don't you do your real work and find Fazlullah and those whose hands are red with the blood of Swat?" That Ramadan, a friend of my father's in Karachi called Wakil Khan sent clothes for the poor, which he wanted us to distribute. We went to a big hall to hand them out. Before we had even started, intelligence agents came and asked, "What are you doing? Who brought these outfits?" On July 12, I turned 14, which in Islam means you are an adult. With my birthday came the news that Taliban had killed the owner of the Swat Continental Hotel, who was on a peace committee. He was on his way from home to his hotel in Mingora Bazaar when they ambushed him in a field. Once again, people started worrying that the Taliban were creeping back. But whereas in 2008 and 2009 there were many threats to all sorts of people, this time these threats were very specific to those who spoke against militants and the high-handed behavior of the army. "The Taliban is not an organized force like we imagine," said my father's friend Hidayatullah when they discussed it. "It's a mentality, and this mentality is everywhere in Pakistan. Someone who is against America, against the Pakistan establishment, against English law, he has been infected by the Taliban." It was late in the evening of August 3rd when my father received an alarming phone call from a GOTV correspondent called Mehboob. He was the nephew of my father's friend, Zahib Khan, the hotel owner who had been attacked in 2009. People used to say both Zahid Khan and my father were on the Taliban radar and both would be killed. The only thing they didn't know was which would be killed first. Mehboob told us that his uncle had been on his way to Isha prayers, the last prayers of the day, at the mosque on the street near his house when he was shot in the face. When he heard the news, my father said the earth fell away from his feet. "It was as if I had been shot," he said. "I was sure it was my turn next." We pleaded with my father not to go to the hospital, as it was very late at night, and the people who attacked Zahid Khan might be waiting for him. But he said not to go would be cowardly. He was offered an escort by some fellow political activists, but he thought that it would be too late to go if he waited for them. So he called my cousin to take him. My mother began to pray. When he got to the hospital, only one other member of the Jirga committee was there. Zahid Khan was bleeding so much, it was as if his white beard was bathed in red. But he had been lucky. A man had fired at him from close range, 3 times with a 9mm pistol. But Zahid Khan had managed to grab his hand, so only the first bullet struck. Strangely, it went through his neck and out through his nose. Later, he said he remembered a small, clean-shaven man just standing there, smiling, not even wearing a mask. The darkness overcame him as if he had fallen into a black hole. The irony was, Zahid Khan had only recently started to walk to the mosque again because he thought it was safe. After praying for his friend, my father talked to the media. "We don't understand why he's been attacked when they claim there's peace," he said. "It's a big question for the army and administration." People warned my father to leave the hospital. "Ziauddin, it's midnight and you're here. Don't be stupid," they said. "You are as vulnerable and as wanted a target as he is. Don't take any more risks." Finally, Zahid Khan was transferred to Peshawar to be operated on, and my father came home. I had not gone to sleep because I was so worried. After that, I double-checked all the locks every night. At home, our phone did not stop ringing, with people calling to warn my father he could be the next target. Hidayatullah was one of the first to call. "For God's sake, be careful," he warned. "It could have been you. They are shooting Jirga members one by one. You are the spokesman. How can they possibly let you live?" My father was convinced the Taliban would hunt him down and kill him, but he again refused security from the police. "If you go around with a lot of security, the Taliban will use Kalashnikovs or suicide bombers and more people will be killed," he said. "At least I'll be killed alone." Nor would he leave Swat. "Where can I go?" he asked my mother. "I cannot leave the area. I am president of the Global Peace Council, the spokesman of the Council of Elders, the president of the Swat Association of Private Schools, director of my school, and head of my family." His only precaution was to change his routine. One day he would go to the primary school first, another day to the girls' school, the next day to the boys' school. I noticed wherever he went, he would look up and down the street 4 or 5 times. Despite the risks, my father and his friends continued to be very active, holding protests and press conferences. "Why was Zahid Khan attacked if there's peace? Who attacked him?" they demanded. "Since we've come back from being IDPs, we haven't seen any attacks on army and police. The only targets now are peace builders and civilians." The local army commander was not happy. "I tell you, there are no terrorists in Mingora," he insisted. "Our reports say so." He claimed that Zahid Khan had been shot because of a dispute over property. Zahid Khan was in hospital for 12 days, then at home recuperating for a month after having plastic surgery to repair his nose. But he refused to be silent. If anything, he became more outspoken, particularly against the intelligence agencies, as he was convinced they were behind the Taliban. He wrote opinion pieces in newspapers, saying that the conflict in Swat had been manufactured. "I know who targeted me. What we need to know is who imposed these militants on us," he wrote. He demanded that the Chief Justice set up a judicial commission to investigate who brought the Taliban into our valley. He drew a sketch of his attacker and said the man should be stopped before shooting anyone else. But the police did nothing to find him. After the threats against me, my mother didn't like me walking anywhere and insisted I get a rickshaw to school and take the bus home, even though it was only a 5-minute walk. The bus dropped me at the steps leading up to our street. A group of boys from our neighborhood used to hang round there. Sometimes there was a boy called Haroon with them, who was a year older than me and used to live on our street. We had played together as children, and later he told me he was in love with me. But then a pretty cousin came to stay with our neighbor Safina, and he fell in love with her instead. When she said she wasn't interested, he turned his attention back to me. After that, they moved to another street, and we moved into their house. Haroon went away to Army Cadet College. But he came back for vacations, and one day when I returned home from school, he was hanging around on the street. He followed me to the house and put a note inside our gate where I would see it. I told a small girl to fetch it for me. He had written, "Now you have become very popular. I still love you and know you love me. This is my number. Call me." I gave the letter to my father and he was angry. He called Haroon and told him he would tell his father. That was the last time I saw him. After that, the boys stopped coming to our street. But one of the small boys who played with Atal would call out suggestively, "How is Haroon?" whenever I passed by. I got so fed up with it that one day I told Atal to bring the boy inside. I shouted at him so angrily that he stopped. I told Muniba what had happened once we were friends again. She was always very careful about interactions with boys because her brothers watched everything. "Sometimes I think it's easier to be a twilight vampire than a girl in SWAT," I sighed. But really, I wished that being hassled by a boy was my biggest problem. 20. Who is Malala? One morning in late summer, when my father was getting ready to go to school, he noticed that the painting of me looking at the sky, which we had been given by the school in Karachi, had shifted in the night. He loved that painting and had hung it over his bed. Seeing it crooked disturbed him. "Please put it straight," he asked my mother in an unusually sharp tone. That same week, our maths teacher, Miss Shazia, arrived at school in a hysterical state. She told my father that she'd had a nightmare in which I came to school with my leg badly burned and she had tried to protect it. She begged him to give some cooked rice to the poor, as we believed if you give rice, even ants and birds will eat the bits that drop to the floor and will pray for us. My father gave money instead, and she was distraught, saying that wasn't the same. We laughed at Miss Shazia's premonition, but then I started having bad dreams too. I didn't say anything to my parents, but whenever I went out, I was afraid that Taliban with guns would leap out at me or throw acid in my face, as they had done to women in Afghanistan. I was particularly scared of the steps leading up to our street, where the boys used to hang out. Sometimes I thought I heard footsteps behind me, or imagined figures slipping into the shadows. Unlike my father, I took precautions. At night, I would wait until everyone was asleep. My mother, my father, my brothers, the other family in our house, and any guests we'd had from our village. Then I'd check every single door and window. I'd go outside and make sure the front gate was locked. Then I would check all the rooms, one by one. My room was at the front with lots of windows, and I kept the curtains open. I wanted to be able to see everything, though my father told me not to. "If they were going to kill me, they would have done it in 2009, I said. But I worried someone would put a ladder against the house, climb over the wall, and break in through a window. Then I'd pray. At night, I used to pray a lot. The Taliban think we are not Muslims, but we are. We believe in God more than they do, and we trust Him to protect us. I used to say the Ayat al-Kursi, the verse of the throne from the second surah of the Quran, the chapter of the cow. This is a very special verse, and we believe that if you say it three times a night, your home will be safe from shayateen or devils. When you say it five times, your street will be safe, and seven times will protect the whole area. So I'd say it seven times or even more. Then I'd pray to God. Bless us. First our father and family, then our street, then our whole mohalla, then all Swat. Then I'd say, no, all Muslims. Then no, not just Muslims, bless all human beings. The time of year I prayed most was during exams. It was the only time when my friends and I did all five prayers a day, like my mother was always trying to get me to do. I found it particularly hard in the afternoon when I didn't want to be dragged away from the TV. At exam time, I prayed to Allah for high marks, though our teachers used to warn us, God won't give you high marks if you don't work hard. God showers us with His blessings, but He is honest as well. So I studied hard too. Usually, I liked exams as a chance to show what I could do. But when they came round in October 2012, I felt under pressure. I did not want to come second to Malka Inur again as I had in March. Then she had beaten me by not just one or two marks, the usual difference between us, but by five marks. I had been taking extra lessons with Sir Amjad, who runs the boys' school. The night before the exams began, I stayed up studying until 3 o'clock in the morning and reread an entire textbook. The first paper on Monday, 8th October, was physics. I love physics because it is about truth, a world determined by principles and laws. No messing around or twisting things like in politics, particularly those in my country. As we waited for the signal to start the exam, I recited holy verses to myself. I completed the paper, but I knew I'd made a mistake filling in the blanks. I was so cross with myself, I almost cried. It was just one question worth only one mark, but it made me feel that something devastating was going to happen. When I got home that afternoon, I was sleepy, but the next day was Pakistan Studies, a difficult paper for me. I was worried about losing even more marks, so I made a coffee with milk to drive away the devils of sleep. When my mother came, she tried it and liked it and drank the rest. I could not tell her, Bobby, please stop it. That's my coffee. But there was no more coffee left in the cupboard. Once again, I stayed up late, memorizing the textbook about the history of our independence. In the morning, my parents came to my room as usual and woke me up. I don't remember a single school day on which I woke up early by myself. My mother made our usual breakfast of sugary tea, chapatis, and fried egg. We all had breakfast together, me, my mother, my father, and Atal. It was a big day for my mother, as she was going to start lessons that afternoon to learn to read and write with Miss Ulfat, my old teacher from kindergarten. My father started teasing Atal, who was 8 by then, and cheekier than ever. Look, Atal, when Malala is Prime Minister, you will be her secretary, he said. Atal got very cross. No, 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 he said. I am no less than Malala. I will be Prime Minister, and she will be my secretary. All the banter meant I ended up being so late I only had time to eat half my egg and no time to clear up. The Pakistan Studies paper went better than I thought it would. There were questions about how Jinnah had created our country as the first Muslim homeland, and also about the national tragedy of how Bangladesh came into being. It was strange to think that Bangladesh was once part of Pakistan, despite being 1,000 miles away. I answered all the questions and was confident I'd done well. I was happy when the exam was over, chatting and gossiping with my friends as we waited for Sher Muhammad Baba, a school assistant, to call for us when the bus arrived. The bus did two trips every day, and that day we took the second bus. We liked staying on at school, and Muniba said, "As we're tired after the exam, let's stay and chat before going home." I was relieved that the Pakistan Studies exam had gone so well, so I agreed. I had no worries that day. I was hungry, but because we were 15, we could no longer go outside to the street. So I got one of the small girls to buy me a corn cob. I ate a little bit of it, then gave it to another girl to finish. At 12 o'clock, Baba called us over the speaker. We all ran down the steps. The other girls all covered their faces before emerging from the door and climbed into the back of the bus. I wore my scarf over my head, but never over my face. I asked the driver, Usman Bhaijan, to tell us a joke while we were waiting for two teachers to arrive. He has a collection of extremely funny stories. That day, instead of a story, he did a magic trick to make a pebble disappear. "Show us how you did it," we all clamored, but he wouldn't. When everyone was ready, he took Miss Ruby and a couple of small children in the front cab with him. Another little girl cried, saying she wanted to ride there too. Usman Bhaijan said no, there was no room. She would have to stay in the back with us. But I felt sorry for her and persuaded him to let her in the cab. Atul had been told by my mother to ride on the bus with me, so he walked over from the primary school. He liked to hang off the tailboard at the back, which made Usman Bhaijan cross as it was dangerous. That day, Usman Bhaijan had had enough and refused to let him. "Sit inside, Atul Khan, or I won't take you," he said. Atul had a tantrum and refused, so he walked home in a huff with some of his friends. Usman Bhaijan started the diner and we were off. I was talking to Muniba, my wise, nice friend. Some girls were singing. I was drumming rhythms with my fingers on the seat. Muniba and I liked to sit near the open back so we could see out. At that time of day, Haji Baba Road was always a jumble of colored rickshaws, people on foot and men on scooters, all zigzagging and honking. An ice cream boy on a red tricycle, decorated with red and white nuclear missiles, rode up behind, waving at us, until a teacher shooed him away. A man was chopping off chickens' heads, the blood dripping onto the street. I drummed my fingers. Chop, chop, chop. Drip, drip, drip. Funny, when I was little, we always said Swatis were so peace-loving, it was hard to find a man to slaughter a chicken. The air smelt of diesel, bread and kebab, mixed with the stink from the stream where people still dumped their rubbish. I were never going to stop despite all of my father's campaigning. But we were used to it. Besides, soon the winter would be here, bringing the snow that would cleanse and quieten everything. The bus turned right off the main road at the army checkpoint. On a kiosk was a poster of crazy-eyed men with beards and caps or turbans under big letters saying wanted terrorists. The picture at the top of a man with a black turban and beard was Fazlullah. More than 3 years had passed since the military operation to drive the Taliban out of Swat had begun. We were grateful to the army, but couldn't understand why they were still everywhere, in machine gun nests on roofs and manning checkpoints. To even enter our valley, people needed official permission. The road up the small hill is usually busy, as it is a shortcut, but that day it was strangely quiet. "Where are all the people?" I asked Muniba. All the girls were singing and chatting, and our voices bounced around inside the bus. Around that time, my mother was probably just going through the doorway into our school for her first lesson since she had left school at age 6. I didn't see the two young men with handkerchiefs tied over their faces step out onto the road and bring the van to a sudden halt. I didn't get a chance to answer their question, "Who is Malala?" or I would have explained to them why they should let us girls go to school as well as their own sisters and daughters. The last thing I remember is that I was thinking about the revision I needed to do for the next day. The sounds in my head were not the crack, crack, crack of the three bullets, but the chop, 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 drip, drip, drip of the man severing their heads of chickens and them dropping into the dirty street one by one. Part 4. Guns of darkness, why would I not curse you? You turned love-filled homes into broken debris. 21. God, I entrust her to you. As soon as Usman Baijan realized what had happened, he drove the diner to SWAT Central Hospital at top speed. The other girls were screaming and crying. I was lying on Muniba's lap, bleeding from my head and left ear. We had only gone a short way when a policeman stopped the van and started asking questions, wasting precious time. One girl felt my neck for a pulse.